Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Wednesday. It's the 10th of July, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. It'll just be you and I today. We don't have any particular guests, especially since the political season ended with the special primary and the results and so on and so forth. We are redoing our entire schedule and bringing back people who may have left because of the summer and for other reasons, and they're coming back now and so on and so forth. So we're redoing our schedule, and then we hope that you'll find it a comfortable one as well. And we tend to repeat our the guests that we have, with some aberrations to that, because sometimes we have these one-shot deals where we celebrate a particular event, and other times it's the same people over and over. You become more familiar with them, and they're in government, whether they're mayors or council people and so on and so forth, senators, assembly people, congressmen, and so on. So it depends on their schedule, and we'll try to fit them in and so on and so forth. And then this is the summer as well. So we have people that normally come on the show but are not going to be around during the summer months. And so it's going to be a little shuffling going on. So today it's just you and I, and we're going to cover a lot of things, mostly on the international as well as the national stage. The first thing which is came to a head is that the United Kingdom's ambassador to Washington has quit over the row that took place with President Trump. So Britain's ambassador to Washington resigned. He resigned today after Donald Trump labeled him stupid and wacky following the release of confidential memos from the envoy in which he branded the United States president's administration as inept. Memos from Kim DeRoche, I don't know how you pronounce his last name, were leaked to a British Sunday newspaper, infuriating Trump, who launched a stinging Twitter attack on both the envoy and the British Prime Minister, Theresa May, who had given him her full support. In a growing spat between the two close allies, Trump said he would no longer deal with DeRoche and called May, quote, foolish, end quote. And in his resignation letter, DeRoche said his position was no longer tenable. Since the leak of official documents from this embassy, there has been a great deal of speculation surrounding my position and the duration of my remaining term as ambassador, he wrote. I want to put an end to that speculation, he added. The current situation is making it impossible for me to carry out my role as I would like, end quote. So in his confidential memo, dating from 2017 to the present, DeRoche, who's 65, had said reports of infighting in the White House were mostly true, quote unquote, and the last month described confusion within the administration over Trump's decision to call off a military strike on Iran. Quote, we don't really believe this administration is going to become substantially more normal, less dysfunctional, less unpredictable, less faction-driven, less diplomatically clumsy and inept, DeRoche wrote in one cable. May, Theresa May, told Parliament that ministers had expressed their backing for DeRoche, a career diplomat who was due to leave his post anyway at the end of the year. Quote, I've told him, it is a matter of great regret that he has felt it necessary to leave his position as ambassador to Washington, she said. The whole cabinet rightly gave its full support to Sir Kim on Tuesday. So the souring of relations between Britain and the United States comes at a particularly unwelcome time for London, which is mired in the details of how and when to leave the European Union, a departure currently scheduled for October 31st. Britain is hoping to strike a major post-Brexit trade deal with Washington as one of the upsides of leaving the bloc. May herself is due to step down as prime minister by the end of July, and while one of the two contenders to replace her, Foreign Minister Jeremy Hunt, had said DeRoche should keep his job, the other frontrunner, Boris Johnson, had pointedly declined to do so. So that's where we're at with that particular situation. And now let's look at what's coming a little bit closer to home. Evidently, the Fed, it seems that uncertainties continue to weigh in on the U.S. economy, uncertain about trade frictions and global growth continues to weigh on the U.S. economy or economic outlook. That's what the Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell said today, keeping the door open to an interest rate cut this month. In his highly anticipated testimony to Congress, Powell had said many central bankers believed the case for lower rates, quote, had strengthened, end quote, last month, given the rising cross currents in the economy. President Donald Trump has been putting intense and constant pressure on the Fed to cut the benchmark interest rates to boost the economy, repeatedly criticizing Powell on Twitter and in public comments. Financial markets, too, were looking for a clear signal about whether the central bank will cut lending rates later this month. And after a blowout U.S. jobs report on Friday, investors became concerned the Fed might make them wait. Powell was not explicit, but in his prepared statement to the House Financial Services Committee, he noted that the Fed in June announced it, quote, would act as appropriate to sustain the expansion, end quote. After raising the key borrowing rate 9 times since 2015, as the economy expanded, most recently in December, the Fed last month opened the door to a rate cut amid signs of slowing. And Powell said that in the weeks since the June policy meeting, quote, it appears that uncertainties around trade tensions and concerns about the strength of the global economy continue to weigh on the U.S. economic outlook. So at the same time, price measures watched closely by the Fed continue to run well below its 2% target, and inflation pressure remains muted, he said, and there is a risk that weak inflation will be even more persistent than we currently anticipate. So Powell has brushed off Trump's attacks, but in his testimony, he noted that Congress has granted the central bank, quote, an important degree of independence, end quote, to conduct policy, quote, based on objective analysis and data, end quote. So in the wake of President Trump's aggressive trade policies, especially with China, Powell said businesses and farmers report heightened concerns about the U.S. economy. Meanwhile, disappointing growth in China and Europe raised fears a weak global economy could impact U.S. growth, which contributed to slowing business investment and waning confidence, he said. So although the U.S. economy expanded by a solid 3.1% in the first 3 months of the year, the Fed chief said that growth was based on factors like exports that are not generally reliable indicators of ongoing momentum, end quote. So the Fed still believes the U.S. economy will post solid growth as labor markets remain healthy, but Powell pointed to other domestic concerns that need to be addressed, including high and rising federal debt. In addition, he said the relative stagnation of middle and lower incomes and low levels of upward mobility for lower income families are also ongoing concerns. The Fed chief is required to testify before Congress twice a year, and Powell will respond to questions from legislators before appearing on Thursday before the Senate Banking Committee. So there's going to be much to hear from him over the next few days. Well, now let's see what's going on, of all places, with Iran. Evidently, there's a French envoy in Tehran who's going to try to de-escalate the Iran crisis. It seems that French envoy Emmanuel Bon is in Tehran on another attempt to convince Iran to come back into compliance with a landmark 2015 deal as the IAEA convenes an emergency meeting in Vienna on Wednesday, that's today, on Iran's nuclear program. France's envoy, Emmanuel Bonne, B-O-N-N-E, will spend 2 days in Iran on a mission from the Elysee Palace to create factors that will lead to de-escalation. French President Emmanuel Macron is seeking to lead European diplomatic efforts to find a face-saving solution to the latest crisis between Tehran and Washington, with the European Union looking to buy time and soothe tensions, diplomats and experts have advised. So the International Atomic Energy Agency will hold an emergency meeting today to discuss Iran's nuclear program. After President Donald Trump unilaterally pulled the United States out of the deal in May of 2018, Iran began enriching uranium to higher levels, leading to fears the faltering accord could be doomed. If it falls apart and Iran continues enriching uranium all the way to levels approaching those that could be used in a weapon, diplomats see a high risk of conflict in the Middle East involving the United States and possibly its ally, Israel. We are buying time. The Iranians are too, the European diplomat told Agence France-Presse on condition of anonymity. We need to bring Iran back on board in exchange for a symbolic gesture from the United States, end quote. So analysts agree that European efforts in the short term have to be twofold, convincing Iran to stop enriching, then convincing Trump to suspend some of the crippling new economic sanctions he has imposed on Tehran. And, quote, it's about creating the condition for both sides, the United States and Iran, to back away from the corners that they are stuck in, because the end game here is negotiation. And that's what Sanam Vakil, an Iran specialist at the Chatham House in London think tank, had said. So for Iran to come back to the negotiating table, they have made it abundantly clear there will have to be sanctions relief granted. Macron is using the space that France has gotten to try to arrange a situation which could be helpful to the Iranians, of course, but also helpful to the United States and to Trump, who is in a very bad position in his view, added Dominique Trinquant, a former head of the French UN military mission and defense minister advisor to Macron during his 2017 presidential campaign. Macron has taken an active mediation role, speaking to Iranian President Hassan Rouhani and Trump in recent days. Last year, he was weighing whether to become the first French leader to travel to Tehran since 1976, but tensions over the nuclear issue and Iran's involvement in the wars in Syria and Yemen meant he never accepted an invitation to visit. Well, Iran's alleged role in a plot to bomb a meeting of opposition activists at a political meeting near Paris in June killed off any possibility, a diplomat say. And that's while France maintained a tough stance on many of Iran's actions in the Middle East. Quote, I've heard some pretty strong language from Paris, particularly when it comes to ballistic missiles and when it comes to Iran's regional behavior. Michael Pregon, a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C., had advised. Well, so I think Macron's position on the Iran deal is actually shoring up Trump's Prejean had continued. Nevertheless, recent French media reports suggest that Macron might once again be considering traveling to meet Rouhani and Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Well, individually, he is probably the best placed to be the E3 leader, said Vakil, referring to the E3 group of European powers, which comprises France, Germany, and Britain. Everyone is talking to each other, the European diplomat told Agence France-Presse on condition of anonymity. Macron relishes the world stage, but his efforts at mediating in the Middle East have led to mixed results. He successfully intervened in November of 2017 to free Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri after he was detained by Saudi authorities during a trip to the country. but his efforts to create a solution to the crisis in war-torn Libya have yet to yield fruit, and he has made enemies in Italy, the former colonial power in Libya, as well as in the United Nations recognized government in Tripoli. Past efforts at lobbying Trump to respect the nuclear deal, particularly during a state visit to Washington in April 2018, came to naught. And experts say that for the moment, Iran is not close to enriching uranium to levels that could be used for a weapon, which could spark a regional arms race and acute security fears in Israel. But it is considered by the European powers to be in breach of its commitments. The country's Atomic Energy Organization announced on Monday that it had surpassed a cap on the level to which it can enrich uranium, reaching 4.5% above the 3.67% limit stipulated in the deal. It has also exceeded limits on its stockpile of enriched uranium set in the 2015 accord signed by the United States, Iran, Russia, China, Britain, Germany, France, and the European Union. So European nations are seen as wanting to avoid triggering a dispute mechanism in the text, which could lead to sanctions being reimposed. And such a move would heighten tensions, while the threat to fresh sanctions remain one of the few levers available to the Europeans as they seek to convince Iran to respect the deal. But the road they are taking by enriching further could force us to take a road we don't want to take, another French diplomat told Agence France-Presse, on condition of anonymity. So people are caught between a rock and a hard place, as they say. Well, there are sanctions, though, coming down the pike. Evidently, United States sanctions Lebanese Hezbollah ministers of parliament over the Iran support. So, the U.S. Treasury placed two Hezbollah members of Lebanon's parliament on its sanctions blacklist yesterday. The first time Washington has taken aim at the Iran-allied group's elected politicians. Stepping up its effort to build global pressure on the powerful Lebanese Shiite movement, the Treasury named ministers of parliament Amin Sherry and Mohammed Hassan Raad to a terror-related blacklist, saying that Hezbollah uses its parliamentary power to advance violent activities. Also placed on the blacklist was Wafiq Safa, a top Hezbollah official close to the movement's Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah. And U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that the U.S. targeted three officials who leverage their positions to facilitate Hezbollah and the Iranian regime's maligned effort to undermine Lebanese sovereignty. So any distinction between Hezbollah's political and military wings is artificial, he said. We call on our allies and partners to designate Hezbollah in its entirety as a terrorist organization. Well, Pompeo tied the action to the United States' maximum pressure campaign against Iran and its proxies in the Middle East, including Hezbollah, which Washington has officially designated a terrorist group. However, Washington stopped short of imposing similar sanctions on Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, while Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said were forthcoming Mnuchin had said were forthcoming in late June. Well, a senior administration official who insisted on anonymity on Tuesday would not confirm any plan to blacklist Zarif, who was crucial in achieving the landmark 2015 nuclear deal. We are obviously exploring various avenues for additional sanctions on Tehran. Obviously, Foreign Minister Zarif is a figure of key interest, she said. It is the first time the United States Treasury has placed Hezbollah lawmakers on its blacklist, which forbids U.S. individuals and businesses with a U.S. branch, including leading international banks, from doing business with those sanctioned. And with the electoral backing of many Lebanese Shiites, Hezbollah won 13 seats out of 128 in the May 6, 2018 general election. It joined a coalition government formed on January 31st, gained control of three ministries. But Washington says it will not regard the group's political and military activities as separate from one another. It is time, we believe, for other nations around the world to recognize that there is no distinction between Hezbollah's political and military wing, the senior U.S. Administration official said. To any member of Hezbollah considering running for office, know that you will not be able to hide behind the cover of political office, she said. Ra'ad, who is 64, is the head of the parliamentary bloc of the party and minister of parliament since 1992. Sheri, who is 62, is a 17-year Hezbollah veteran of parliament representing Beirut. Safa, the treasury said, maintains the group's ties to financiers and allegedly helps arrange the smuggling of weapons and drugs. The newest sanctions brought to 50 the number of Hezbollah individuals and entities blacklisted by the Treasury since 2017. And they have included bankers and businessmen that Washington says are deeply involved in Hezbollah business activities around the world, allegedly including narcotics trafficking and gun running. The sanctions have aimed particularly at companies and individuals who help the group move money throughout the Middle East. The Hezbollah lawmaker Ali Fayyad told Lebanon's MTV news channel that the new sanctions Tuesday were, quote, a humiliation for the Lebanese people, end quote, and called on parliament and the government to issue a formal condemnation. Lebanese finance minister Ali Hassan Khalil, meanwhile, tweeted that the U.S. sanctions were, quote, unjustified, end quote, and, quote, concern all of the Lebanese, even if they are directed at Hezbollah, end quote. Pompeo said that the U.S. pressure on Iran and Hezbollah was having an effect on the Lebanese group's operations. Quote, as a result, this designated terrorist organization has been forced to take unprecedented austerity measures. For example, in March of 2019, for the first time, Hezbollah's leader, Hassan Nasrallah, made a public appeal for financial support. So that's the situation that's going there, which is very, very interesting. Now, this is really fascinating. We got this from Agence France Press. This is France 24, and this is with respect to hummus. It's a Middle Eastern dish, which in their report, which I haven't heard yet, is about hummus having an identity crisis. So let's hear what goes on. It says, the introduction is, this week we're bringing you a special show all about hummus, a tasty spread made from ground chickpeas. Believe it or not, this dish is charged with cultural significance, with many debates in the Middle East over who invented it. And the France 24 show says they're joined by Dan Alexander, a Franco-Israeli chief editor and designer, who's just published on the hummus route, and he tells France 24 more about this unusual source of tension, but also how it brings people together. So this might be very, very interesting. I hope you'll enjoy it.
Here. Of Route 23 in Hillsdale.
1 second.
And tell us, who do we have coming to the festival this year?
Hold on a minute.
Full talent.
I see.
Okay.
I see what happened. We had another thing in the background, so bear with me a moment. And, okay, this should be all right now. Okay. 1 second. Let's see if we can start this up. Yep.
Hello, very warm welcome to Middle East Matters. I'm Sanam Shanti. This week, we're bringing you a special show all about the region's most contentious legume. That's the chickpea. More specifically, hummus, a thick spread made from ground chickpeas. And believe it or not, this dish is charged with cultural significance, and there have been many debates over who invented it. Now, joining me here to talk about hummus throughout the show is Dan Alexander. Dan is a Franco-Israeli chief editor and designer, and he just published this wonderful book, an entire book on hummus, this unusual source of tension in the region. The book is called On the Hummus Route. Dan, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Sanam. Thank you for having me.
Now, first, let's take a close look at what exactly hummus is and how it's made.
few handfuls of chickpeas, some sesame paste, a squeeze of lemon juice, a good dose of garlic, and a generous glug of olive oil, the basic recipe for hummus. The first known references to the dish date to ancient Mesopotamia in around 700 BC. Its modern form is believed to have first appeared in the Ottoman Empire some 600 years ago. Today, paprika...
Doing what happened there for a second. We'll see what goes on here. Let's see if this continues. Bear with me a moment. That's a weird response. Okay, I may just have to redo this. Unless something happens to this, because I hadn't heard this before. And hopefully it'll get started in a moment. Okay, it looks like it's activating again. And we'll see where it lands in a moment. All right, 1 second. Oh, this is going to be very interesting. Okay.
Hello, very warm welcome to Middle East Matters. I'm Sanam Shanti. This week we're bringing you a special show all about the region's most contentious legume. That's the chickpea. More specifically, hummus, a thick bread made from ground chickpeas. And believe it or not, the fish is charged with cultural significance, and there have been many debates over who invented it. Now, joining me here to talk about hummus throughout the show is Dan Alexander. Dan is a Franco-Israeli chief editor and designer, and he just published this wonderful book, an entire book on hummus, this unusual source of tension in the region. The book is called On the Hummus Route. Dan, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Sanan. Thank you for having me.
Now, first, let's take a close look at what exactly hummus is and how it's made.
A few handfuls of chickpeas, some sesame paste, a squeeze of lemon juice, a good dose of garlic, and a generous glug of olive oil, the basic recipe for hummus. The first known references to the dish date to ancient Mesopotamia in around 700 BC. Its modern form is believed to have first appeared in the Ottoman Empire some 600 years ago. Today, paprika, cumin, sumac, and pine nuts are popular additions. But there aren't as many variations as there are people laying claim to its paternity. Among the most insistent, the Lebanese, the Palestinians, and the Israelis. And the hummus war is no joke. The Lebanese were so determined to prove their dedication to the dish that in 2010, they set out to create the world's largest ever hummus dish, weighing in at an impressive 10.5 tons. And that was in response to a 4-ton effort mounted by the Israeli-Palestinian village of Abu Ghosh that same year. Greece, Jordan, Turkey, Syria, and even Egypt have also laid claim to hummus. Proof that the humble chickpea is capable of sharpening appetites, both culinary and nationalist.
Dan, we just took a look at how hummus is made, and of course, this is a relatively simple dish to make, though I have been known to fail. But I think the variations lie in the fact that it's served in different ways. Can you talk us through the 5 different hummus dishes that we have here? They were made by Franco-Lebanese chef Karim Haydar.
Yeah. So, Sanam, the number of variation of hummus in the Middle East is like the number of the people in the Middle East. It's amazing. So the first one that you are seeing now, it's hummus bil-tahine in Arabic, which is hummus with tahini sauce. So it would be the chickpea, the tahine, the lemon juice, garlic, and some
really
olive oil.
I can really taste the lemon.
Yeah. So that would be the first one, is the most basic recipe of hummus. The second one would be hummus bil-shatta. Hummus bil-shatta, the origin comes from Gaza, and it's the basic hummus recipe with red hot chili pepper. And people in Gaza are eating very spicy and very hot.
I was told not to try this,
yeah,
but I did.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
We have a third one here.
Yeah, that's called itziya. It's hummus that originally come from Jerusalem, El Quds. So it's like hummus from Jerusalem, and it's like the basic recipe of the hummus. And on top you can find the fava bean paste, which originally comes from Egypt.
That's my favorite so far.
Yeah, that's very common. That's a very interesting hummus. It's called masabakha in Arabic, which it means swimming. So you can see that the small, nice chickpeas swimming nicely with their own sauce, with tahini, with parsley, with the pilpel shatta, the pepper shatta.
And of course, the chickpeas are still in their original form. They haven't
Yeah, exactly. And they stay a whole a chickpea. And the last one is hummus beiruti, come from Beirut, from Lebanon, which again, it's the basic recipe with pine nuts, lots of garlic, parsley, and olive oil.
The garlic is very potent. And of course, speaking of this beiruti hummus, we're going to cross over now to the Lebanese capital, where France 24 spoke to people on the streets to get a real sense of what hummus means to them.
I believe hummus is important for the entire Mediterranean culture. Hummus is a traditional dish in Lebanon. It's been traditional for a long time. You can eat it with a lot of things, grilled meat, shawarma. You can find it in other countries. Here in Lebanon, it's the most important dish for us. It's very important. You don't need anyone to teach you how to do it. It's from our mothers, our grandmothers, the family. You always make hummus. There's nothing difficult about it. It's part of the Lebanese tradition. When you pick it out, it's like picking out a part of Lebanon.
I learned how to make hummus from my grandmother when I was little. In the house, you can create or add anything to hummus. Everything can be tried, but you can't play around with the traditional hummus.
And we just heard from there, from people on the streets of Beirut, of course. And interestingly, your book has been presented in the form of a map, the journey of the chickpea from city to city. This map here, tell us about that.
Yeah, so on the hummus route is a journey between cities, people, and dreams. And what is interesting about the map that it doesn't have any borders. It's no borders, no countries, no any oppressive systems. So we are focusing on the cities and people itself that living in those cities. So the book itself divided for 9 chapters, each chapter dedicated to one of the capital of hummus in the Middle East. So we've started in Cairo, going through Gaza, Jaffa, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, up till Damascus.
So you have 9 chapters and you have actually over 30 contributors. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so in each chapter, we are showing people that are living in those cities and was nice enough to contribute their point of view. So you can find their chefs, academics, philosophers, photographers, people that own restaurants, just very simple people that share with us their dreams of their city and the hummus itself.
Give us one example.
One example that I like very much is Karim Aida,
who made these hummus dishes for
exactly,
us, yeah.
Which is an amazing chef, which originally comes from Beirut, and when he doesn't have any memories of hummus when he was a child, so he got into hummus just after he was working here as a chef in a renowned restaurant in Paris. So for me, it's kind of he redefined his identity, discovering the hummus again.
Now, speaking of identity, hummus has been claimed by many different countries in the region, including Palestine, Israel, Lebanon, and Syria. And this report takes a look at how, for some in Palestine, the dish has become a symbol of resistance.
There's only one main dish, and the recipe is a closely guarded secret. At the famous Abu Shukri restaurant, Yasser Taha prepares the hummus each morning, as he has done for more than 60 years, the way he learned it from his father.
I love my work. It's in my blood, in my body. I make hummus with my hands.
By 10 a.m. Saturday morning, the restaurant's packed. Falafel and pickles are served, a slideshow to accompany the famous hummus.
They welcome us warmly with love. Really, they do it with heart. You won't find the same thing elsewhere.
every time I come to Jerusalem, I come to this place.
Palestine, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon. He's not sure of the exact origin, but he does insist on one thing.
The Jews for a long time have claimed they created hummus. But the truth is that we created it, not them.
Claiming paternity of hummus has become a form of Palestinian resistance. The Hamuda Corporation has made this its main focus, marketing Palestinian origin products since 1989.
It means that we exist, that we are the owners of this land. We are workers. We will stay here. We are looking to expand into new markets and reach new consumers. We are making efforts to enter the European market via Italy.
Hamuda products are sold in the West Bank, Gaza and East Jerusalem, but maybe for not much longer. Israel has notified the company to stop selling in Jerusalem.
And that was a report from our team on the ground, Cécile Galluccio and Antoine Mariotti. Now, Dan, you said that you wanted to stay away from politics in this book, but how is that possible, given that we are talking about such a controversial dish?
I'm not a politician, and I hate politics. For me, it's very, very easy. I don't get into this discussion. For me, it's also very easy because I know that hummus is a Palestinian dish. But more than that, what we are offering in the book is a new social order. We offer a dialogue, which in this dialogue, we give each other the very basic ethical demand to exist, to live equally, to love and to dream.
But of course, someone does get political. You have one of the Israeli writers saying that she refuses to buy hummus from any non-Arabs. And on that note, I want to talk about your favorite chapter, which is on Gaza.
Yeah, for me, the most beautiful chapter is Gaza, because I think it's for the first time you see people, you see children. You see children going out of school, eating falafel and hummus because that's the cheapest dish that they can have. So for me, this challenge of humanize the dehumanized people living there, for me, it's an amazing thing to show the world about this invisible city.
So you wanted to humanize, very briefly if you can, Dan, but of course there has been backlash.
Yeah. Someone told me that the book will succeed if we are going to get the bullets from all directions. So happily, we've got them already. There are a lot of backlash from people, frightening people, people that sending very nasty comments. But we are strong, and we believe in our way. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one.
Dan Alexander, on that note, thank you very much for the co-authors of this wonderful book, Hummus. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Sunan. Thank you so much.
And thank you for watching this special edition of Middle East Matters.
Well, that was good. I'm sorry that you had to go through that little quirk. So we had to play it again from the beginning. But that was interesting. Very, very interesting. Well, something else is going on in the world stage. It seems that dozens of migrants are rescued at sea as Italy closes its key migrant center. So it seems that Italy's hardline interior minister, Matteo Salvini, yesterday closed a migrant center in Sicily. He called the largest in Europe, while underlining the decrease in migrants since the populist government took office a year ago. Salvini, who is also deputy prime minister, told reporters in Mineo, which is in Sicily, that the number of migrants in centers across Italy has gone down from 182,000 a year ago to 107,000 today. He also added that asylum requests had halved to about 30,000. Now, the center in Mineo has been slated to close for years, with prosecutors uncovering illegal activities inside, including an alleged Nigerian drug trafficking ring. It was also part of a huge bribery and kickback scandal involving migrant housing. Mineo at one point held as many as 4,000 migrants. Calvini said that its closure would free up hundreds of thousands of euros a day in public money, as well as law enforcement resources, even though one of the reasons that the previous government didn't close Mineo was due to its role as an employer and economic driver for the area. So Interior Ministry figures showed that 3,073 migrants arrived in Italy so far this year, many from Tunisia and Pakistan. That compared with 17,000 in the same period last year and 85,000 a year earlier. So these figures include the 47 migrants brought to shore in the Sicilian port of Pozzallo early on Tuesday by Italy's police. Salvini's announcement came as the Alan Kurdi migrant rescue ship had saved another 44 lives, including women and children, far from their stricken vessel in the Mediterranean. And Malta has agreed to take in those rescued and is sending a vessel to pick them up. The German charity CIEYE, and ship's operator said that on Tuesday, it brings the total number of people rescued by the Alan Kurdi ship to over 100 in recent days after it picked up 65 shipwrecked migrants last week. Those migrants were also taken to Malta, with Italian ports closed to humanitarian rescue ships on Salvini's orders. There have been dozens of standoffs with rescue ships attempting to dock in Italy since the populist government took office in June of 2018, but some migrant boats continue to arrive in Italy on their own and are dubbed ghost arrivals by the media. Salvini insisted that every arrival was counted. They can be big, medium, or small. NGO, meaning non-governmental organization, children, wooden boats, sailboats, paddle boats, the Interior Ministry counts them all. There is no such thing as ghost ships, Salvini said. And earlier on Tuesday, Salvini sent a letter to his counterpart in Tunisia, notifying him that repatriation would be accelerated. So that seems to be the situation there, which is just very, very interesting, to say the least. one second. And this is interesting on some local news. Evidently, the New York Post writes that Cy Vance's challenger has slammed the district attorney for downgrading Epstein's sex offender status. A challenger to Manhattan District Attorney Cy Vance called on the prosecutor yesterday for his kid's glove treatment of convicted pedophile Jeffrey Epstein following the multi-millionaire financier's arrest on charges he, quote, sexually exploited and abused dozens of underage girls. It's long past time for District Attorney Vance to end his silence and explain why his office went to court to reduce the sex offender status of Jeffrey Epstein, said New York law professor Alvin Bragg, a Democrat who has already announced he's taken on Vance in 2021. During a 2011 sex offender registry hearing, Vance's office inexplicably argued to downgrade Epstein, who was required to register in 2008 under a sweetheart non-prosecution plea deal in Miami involving one underage victim, from level 3 to the less restrictive level 1 status. Now, despite a detailed state assessment obtained by the New York Post that deemed Epstein highly dangerous and likely to prey again. Why did the district attorney's office ignore a confidential state assessment that deemed Epstein to be highly dangerous, which lawyers to Mr. Epstein approached the office to have his offender status reduced? Bragg raged in a statement. It's not enough to send a spokesman out to say our prosecutor made a mistake. In a case of this seriousness and magnitude, Manhattan residents deserve to hear from the district attorney himself on how, how this egregious, bear with me a moment. One second. Yeah, it's just where I was, I lost the space. It's not enough to send a spokesman out to say our prosecutor made a mistake in a case of this seriousness and magnitude. That's what Manhattan residents are said to be deserving to hear from the DA himself on how this egregious decision was made. Epstein, who's 66, was arrested Saturday for allegedly paying underage girls hundreds of dollars for nude massages at his Manhattan and Palm Beach homes that would become increasingly sexual in nature. Fans has a history of going easy on high-profile pervs or perverts. His office let disgraced movie mogul Harvey Weinstein off the hook after the producer admittedly groped a model in 2015. It was later revealed that Vance had received $26,550 in campaign donations from Weinstein's lawyer, with some of the dough coming after the investigation was dropped. Vance's office did not immediately return a request for comment to the New York Post. So just very, very compelling, don't you think? Let's move on and see what else is going on in our world. And one second. This is interesting with respect to Syracuse. It says Syracuse should make cops work more hours, fix the payroll, automate trash pickup. That's what a study says. Seems that a changing police officers' shifts to a 40-hour week would save taxpayers in Syracuse up to $3.4 million a year and allow the city to hire 27 more cops, according to a new report from New York State. That's what we've been saying here about Yonkers. Unbelievable. Well, the 50-page report from the state's Financial Restructuring Board outlines more than a dozen ways the city, bear with me a moment. One second. It's almost impossible now. Every time you turn on a page, something gets thrown up as like an advert on the internet. So where is it here? Yeah, the Financial Restructuring Board looked at the city's books and practices and recommended places to save money, and those recommendations could come with up to $5 million in state money if the city decides to pursue them. Mayor Ben Walsh and the Common Council asked the board to examine Syracuse last year. The report was quietly uploaded to a state-run website last month. Much of what is in here we have seen before, and much of what is in here we are already working on some form or fashion, Walsh said in an interview Monday with the Post Standard of Syracuse. I look at it as positive reinforcement and validation for the path we're on. I mean, such drivel. Well, then why didn't you institute it? I'm glad you were thinking about it. It's just the same crap you hear every time from politicians who permit this corruption to go on under their watch. This is so typical of one government after the next. The report recommends cutting costs for police, fire, and public works employees by negotiating better deals with public unions. And those departments are the city's biggest cost drivers. One of those recommendations involves switching police officers from a 4-2 schedule to a 5-2 schedule. Right now, patrol cops work 4 days on, followed by 2 days off, as reported by the Post Standard last year. And that schedule means each officer works 128 fewer hours per year than he or she would on a regular 40-hour schedule. It also allows more opportunities for overtime to fill regular shifts. This is the same problem we have in Yonkers, overtime. Changing police shifts to a 5-2 schedule would save the city $3.4 million a year, allowing the department to add 27 new full-time officers and keep its budget flat, according to the report. It's exactly what we've been saying. So the 4-on, 2-off schedule has the effect of increasing the size of the required workforce beyond what it would otherwise need to be, the report says. We work it differently in Yonkers. In Yonkers, we don't have this 4-on, 2 days off. What we have is where they work their time slot, but then certain people get overtime, and that overtime is time and a half, and that drives the equation forward. Stop with the overtime, hire new staff, and give them the regular pay, and that's it. But they permit, it was at one time last year, it was up to 60 hours overtime every 2 weeks. 60 hours every 2 weeks overtime. And then there was an attempt to push it back to 40 hours overtime every 2 weeks. And I'm not sure where it ended up at the end of the day. It still could be at 40 or may have been pushed back up to 60, but I don't know. So last year, the police union president said the officers work hard every day, often without lunch breaks, and deserve the shift schedule they have. You know, okay, that's great. That's what the police union said. You know, that's like our PBA here in Yonkers. The report also suggests reducing the amount of sick leave and paid time off given to cops and firefighters, another contractual issue, and increasing the amount all city employees contribute to their health care plans. So the high levels of sick leave currently offered to uniformed police and fire create little incentive for employees to preserve that time for true sickness or non-job-related injury. The report says it's likely that this lucrative allocation of sick leave results in more generous utilization of sick leave, which in turn generates a need to backfill assigned shifts on overtime. So according to the report, the median police officer used 41.2 hours of sick leave in the first 11 months of 2018. So the FRB report defined two places where it will offer specific sums of money to help the city. It will award up to $2 million toward the city's effort to pursue its streetlights and outfit them with new light-emitting diodes. Work on that project is already underway. The state money could be used to develop a municipal Wi-Fi network or install some other types of sensors on the lights as part of the city's new smart grid. And the state will also provide $2 million grant for the city to adopt a new payroll processing and timekeeping system for the city's 1,719 employees. It's something Walsh said his administration has been working to overhaul since day one, but hasn't had the money to fully complete it. So everybody's got a reason why things haven't moved ahead. Unbelievable. Anyway, so that's the story, and that seems to be very compelling. So just bear with me a moment. I want to just make sure to get a hold of this and study the entire report from the Syracuse.com website. Okay. And let me just see if we're able to get this, because I want to review it and then see if there are similarities that we can incorporate for use here in our studies of Yonkers. So just bear with me one moment. I want to just make sure that I have this in place. Okay, let me just see if we got this. All right, one moment here. Okay, I think this has come through. All right, so whatever the case is, we'll see, and hopefully it did come through, and we'll be able to utilize this in a moment. And in one second. Oh. All right, let's see if we can take this down like we should. And all right, I think that'll work. All right, let's just see what else is going on. If there's anything else that we can share with you at the moment. And I think that we're actually on target. All right, I think we are. So let me see. Tomorrow is another day. Tomorrow is Wednesday. Tomorrow we're going to be talking to our friends at the Driving Me Crazy crowd. We're going to speak to Lori and John Wiles. And I don't remember exactly which car we're covering tomorrow, but we'll have that posted, so you'll know that sometime today. And I guess that's where we're at. So I want to thank you again for being with us today. And we'll speak to you tomorrow. And just have a great day. Enjoy it. And be well. And goodbye. Where is it here?